City here.
I wonder if they went downtown.
Wow.
Okay, good morning, everybody, and welcome, obviously, to our Wednesday. We're going to talk about rights and law and the Declaration of Independence today. So I just want to warn you, first of all, I'm dressed up like this. I wish that I always did. I would do it. It is very rare for me to look like this, but for some reason I have a meeting today over in Moss Hall. I don't know if this is good or bad. So I have been summoned, and I'll let you know Friday what happened. And I also, I think I'm getting whatever everybody else is getting right now. So if I sound a little groggy, my apologies. I'm not sure how much I'm working on here mentally. Spiritually, I think I'm okay, but mentally, I'm off, physically as well. Okay, so we started talking about the Declaration on Monday, and I want to go through types of rights here, and I hope this isn't too dry. I think it's actually really interesting overall, but it might be a little dry just going through it as I'm going to go through it as specifically as I will and trying to parse one kind of right from another, and I want to try and explain why Americans believe in what they do. So our entire American founding period, and I don't want anyone ever to think there is a founding. There's no such thing as a founding. We go through a whole time period from about 1760 up until about 1793. And of course, I mentioned Lewis and Clark, so we can even take it a little bit farther. But our founding period is generally regarded as the 30-year period, or almost 30-year, 32-year period, between, or 33-year period, between 1760 and 1793. So during that time period, we're going to find a number of different people, people like George Washington, James Madison, Thomas Jefferson, Benjamin Franklin, Luther Martin, people like Charles Carroll, John Dickinson. They all have their own ideas. So don't ever think that there's kind of a monolithic understanding of what's going on. There's also, during the American Revolution, a lot of opposition to the Revolution. So we tend to call these people loyalists. It's not quite fair because they actually did believe very strongly in America. Most of those loyalists weren't so loyal to Britain as they were worried that we were rushing into revolution too quickly. So they ended up being on the side of Britain. They almost all regretted it later, especially after they went back to Britain and had to live there. They were not happy with that. So, but in general, you could say that the American population throughout this time period up until Independence Day. So, actual independence, when we signed the Peace of Paris in 1783 and the war is over. Up until that time, you always have probably about 10% of the American population that is solidly in favor of the American Revolution. And then you have probably 10% of the population that is very pro-British and solidly against the American Revolution. Almost everybody else, all 80% of Americans, fall somewhere in between. And they're never consistent. So at one point, they might be near British troops, and they might feel the familial need to be pro-British. And the next day, they might be near revolutionary troops, and they might feel the need to be revolutionary. So most people kind of went back and forth and were trying to see how things would play out. So the hardcore patriots, as we would think of them, really only are about 10%. And they are risking everything. One thing I get so frustrated with when I see people talking about, especially when I see most academics talking about the founding, they'll say something to the effect, well, these guys were just out to secure their own business or their own rights or their own property, and there could be nothing further from the truth than that. Washington lost huge amounts of money. Charles Carroll, who was the wealthiest American at the time, by far lost almost a third of his estate simply because of what was needed. He and Washington almost single-handedly funded the army, and that's their own personal wealth that they gave up. George Rogers Clark, the older brother of William Clark of Lewis and Clark at fame, went totally broke funding the Virginian army during the war, never recovered, in fact, ended up in debtor's prison because he had paid for the war. So these people gave up a lot. It was not some kind of thing where, oh yes, we'll have everybody fight for us and then we'll gain out of this. So don't ever, this isn't like a Marxist revolution or a fascist revolution. This is truly something unique and something different. And these men, when they say at the end of the Declaration, they are giving up their fortunes, their lives, and their sacred honor, they mean it. This is, if they are caught, they will be executed. And they know that. So they're giving everything, and almost every person who was on the front line knew that they were giving everything. This was truly a citizens' war as they saw it. Regardless, there are only a few of those people, but they're enough that make America work. And it's not going to be easy by any means. It's going to take a lot of help from the Dutch, the Danes, and especially the French. But they are able to get this thing through. So where does all this begin? Why do we start in 1760? It's a really kind of fun, bizarre moment in 1760. It's in February of that year. And there's a guy who's a lawyer in Boston. He's kind of respected. He's kind of a town egghead. He's a bit eccentric. He drinks all the time. Everybody knows it. That was a pretty common problem, actually, before refrigeration, as you can imagine. Alcohol was about the only way you could get potable liquid anywhere, so everybody drank, but it depends how much you drank. And this guy tended to drink a lot. His name was James Otis. And he's really only known for one thing, this one moment in his life. It is a great moment, but it really is only this one moment. James Otis is deeply offended by what the British have done. And I could go into way too much on this side, and I got to be careful about this. But the British, as I've mentioned a couple of times, never once wanted an empire. They had always wanted colonies, but they had not thought in terms of this large thing. They looked at a map and said, oh yeah, we need to secure that route, or we need that land, or we need those resources. But there was never really a plan where the king or queen of England and the government sat down and said, okay, this is how we're going to conquer the world. This is what we're going to do. It was mostly done through individual programs, often companies, whether it's the Hudson's Bay Company or the East India Tea Company. And it's blurred, so it would be as though IBM or Apple were armed, and they had their own security forces, and they would go move into certain, which they kind of do, actually, when you think about it. But this was the situation. And so corporations almost always had their own armies, but they would have the backing of the British Army, maybe, depending on what was going on. And usually the board of directors of any corporation was pretty similar to the people in Parliament. So there's not a lot of distinction between a corporation and a business in Britain. But the British had found themselves with this empire. And one of the greatest men ever in world history was a guy named William Pitt the Elder. And he became the British Prime Minister. He's a Churchill figure. He became the British Prime Minister in 1758. And this was in the middle of the French and Indian War. He was a diehard pro-American guy. So much so that he did not have a problem thinking that at some point the British government would relocate somewhere to America. His idea of a Great Britain was truly a very mobile thing, where there's no reason that we need to be London. If the center of the British Empire needed to be, say, New York, well, that makes perfect sense. Of course you'd move it to New York. If it's Sydney, Australia, you'd move it there. He doesn't have a set image that we Britons on this soil will conquer the world. He was thinking much more in terms of the British people and the English-speaking peoples. This is what they might do. He loved us. And he decided in 1758, he had to make a choice because the British were losing majorly, significantly, against the French in the Great War for Empire, the 9 Years' War. He was there, and he said, as Prime Minister, coming in, elected in 1758, he said, our goal now is no longer as British people to protect resources. Our job is to protect people. And so he had to decide, do we throw everything into, say, the trade in the South Pacific, or do we protect families in North America? And he decided the goal of the British Empire has to protect the families. That's it. And it's a major, it's the first time the British have a great debate about what empire is. And his idea of empire is the most decentralized, family-friendly, free market empire you can imagine. But he does one thing that really angers the Americans, even though we know he's our ally, and he will remain our ally until he's out of Parliament. And he's a great ally. But he does one thing that angers everybody. He does not like smuggling. You think smuggling is just terrible. This is what pirates do. And this is not what good, civilized people do. And yet, all of America, we had never had any laws regulating our trade. They were there, but no one had ever enforced them. And so everything in America was smuggling. I mean, that's
smuggling just meant trade in America. It's not what it meant in Britain, but it meant that. And he didn't like that, so he said, look, we've got to get a little bit of revenue from the Americans. I don't want to tax the families. This is Pitt. Pitt says, what we'll do is we will issue what are called... This is still prevalent because we've so much lost this spirit. But the British under Pitt issued what were called writs of general assistance. And a writ just means a written order. Right? So these are writs of general assistance. And with this idea of a writ, basically Pitt said, okay, we can send a British agent into a warehouse because of smuggling. And if so, if he finds that this guy who owns this warehouse is smuggling, he can take everything. We'll just confiscate that in the name of the empire. And that would be like a tax. So we're not hurting families, we're just hurting these smugglers. So you go, well, this does not go over well in America. And nobody in America makes the distinction between trader and family. Right? Obviously, these traders are bringing goods in for families, cheap goods, things that we need. And so this does not go over well at all. And it really violates the tenets of common law. And I'll explain that in a moment. So this guy, James Otis, they're having a court hearing. And these courts can only be held in what were called admiralty courts. So the British set up a whole series of admiralty, or basically what that means is you take naval law and you put it on the land. So every American agrees, if you're on the ocean, admiralty law is a good thing. But when you're on land and you're dealing with civilians, you can only have common law. Never, ever, ever anything other than common law. And I'll explain what common law is. But only common law. So the British have created false courts in the way that we get mad. You know, for example, you guys wouldn't have to deal with this yet, but you might someday. If there's a problem with your taxes, you get called in not to a regular court, but to an IRS court. Well, that Otis would not. You can't do that according to common law. That's just ridiculous. That's the government just making stuff up to oppress you for no other reason. So Otis is really drunk. It's early in the morning. Court starts something like 8 in the morning, and you've got three British judges sitting in this admiralty court in Boston, which all Bostonians already think is illegal. And Otis is drunk, and he decides, and he's a great speaker, and for whatever reason, he's even better when he's drunk. And so he's a lawyer, and he walks down into this court, and he walks into it. And just imagine if we've got three judges here, we're hearing a court in session. Otis, this kind of young, dynamic, drunk buffoon, walks in and comes up here right in front of me and just starts talking to you. That's what he does. He totally interrupts the court and he gives the most rousing speech you can imagine about what it means to believe in common law. And two people, this word spreads. Otis is down challenging the judges. It's all illegal. He's in contempt of court. And Bostonians, like you would not believe, flood into the courtroom. And of course, they're going to protect Otis if the judges do something. And now it's turning into a situation where if the judges do something against Otis, the judges are in serious trouble because they've got the mob right there, but it's a very civilized mob. And they are all intently listening to Otis's arguments. And two of the men who were there, who will both credit Otis with the foundation of the American Republic at that moment, are Sam Adams and John Adams. And they are so taken with what Otis says, even in 1816, when Adams is asked why he became a radical. He said, oh, it's that speech in February of 1760 by James Otis. As he put it, it was there that the flame of liberty was ignited. And what Otis says is a very, very good, despite his own mental state at the moment, it was an extraordinary defense of natural rights and common law. So what common law is, and I apologize for those of you who haven't me in Western Heritage, you've heard a lot of this already, but what common law is truly a law that develops strictly because there's conflict. So common law means exactly what it is. Common law develops among the people. It's all it is. So if I have a conflict with one of you, if Jared and I
get into some kind of dispute, maybe over property, maybe my pigs crossed into under the fence into his land and ate his food, and he's pretty ticked about it. Then they got under his front porch and made a mess. And he returns them to me, but he says, you know, Brad, you owe me for damages. These were your pigs. You were not responsible over them. And I say, look, Jared, for years you know we've allowed our pigs to go on each other's land. You're just being a jerk about this. We've done this forever. Well, yeah, better than us coming to blows, because obviously Jared can take me out pretty quickly, you know, we go to court. And that's a common law court. And what does common law say? Well, we get Judge Judy over here. And so there's Judy, and she's going to, we agree, actually, that she can be our judge. This is common law. It's very private. And we say, sure, but we want to make sure that Judy's not too biased here. And so what do? Well, we're going to pick 12 of you, and you're going to make sure that she doesn't get out of control, or that we don't either. And you 12, as a jury, will be neutral. Now, here's the very important thing about juries, and I want you guys, this will be on a test, so you guys, I want everybody to know this. Juries are the single most powerful institution in any free society. There's nothing more powerful, not the president, not the Supreme Court, nobody. And I'll try and explain why they're so powerful. We don't know where juries started. We have no idea. All we know is that when Christian missionaries arrived in England, they already had the jury system. It's a pagan system. So you can imagine if you're a Christian missionary, you're going to have a field day. Well, you guys pick 12? Hey, we know what 12 is. 12 is great. We can talk about the apostles. Of course, this is all very Christian. God put this idea in your heads because you were anticipating we'd arrive. I mean, that's great stuff. But most likely, it's utterly pagan, and it's probably based on the zodiac and the 12 signs of the whole astrological. So it's probably not Christian at all, but it does fit very nicely with the 12. So we don't know where it came from, but we do know this. A jury, always and everywhere, must be made up strictly of people from the same community. So if Jared and I get into a fight, we cannot bring people in from Jonesville. We can't bring people in from Jackson. They have to be Hillsdalians. They have to, because they know us. And yet, they have to know us, but we also want to make sure they don't know us too well. But they have to know the norms. And the reason for this, for the Anglo-Saxons, originally the primitive Anglo-Saxons, was simply that, well, every different place has its own customs and conventions. And so we have to abide by those. Think about the argument. By the way, I totally made that up. I had not planned saying this, but it'll work. So, you know, my pigs went onto his land and ate up his stuff and caused property damage. Well, if there is a tradition in our community that it's okay to let your livestock do that every once in a while, well, then the jury has every right not to find in his favor, but in mine. But in another community where it's not the norm, where fences truly do make great neighbors, well, then in that community, yeah, Jared's absolutely right and I'm wrong. I violated the custom. So what I'm trying to get at here, and I hope this is clear, common law is customary law. And that's why it has to be the community. And you can't go beyond that. So what would happen throughout the Anglo-Saxon period is the king would send judges around to various communities. They'd be circuit judges. They'd move from one community to another, and you'd store up all your cases. And as soon as that judge arrived, you hold the jury, and then you have maybe a month of cases. And then the judge moves on to the next town. And everything is dealt with in that month. But it's all local. And we always, so here's where the jury is so powerful. The jury not only has the right, in fact it has a duty if it sees fit, it not only has the right to find any person innocent, but it actually has the duty to what is called, and if you say this today in most courts, you can actually be arrested. But this is just part of the common law tradition. You actually have the right to nullify the law, which you're doing anyway. I mean, so imagine, let's say that we know really almost beyond a shadow of a doubt that this person committed a crime, but we also know the circumstances why a person committed a crime, and we recognize that there was desperation involved, and so we want to give leniency to some kid who's done something stupid. Well, if the judge, it doesn't matter what the judge thinks, if the jury says, look, the kid's not guilty, it doesn't mean he didn't commit the crime. It means we're not going to punish him for this thing. So every jury has the power to suspend a law at that moment. But think about this in the broad sense, and this is what nullification is. A jury, by its very existence, can actually suspend not the physical laws of time and space, but it can suspend the actual meaning of time and space. Because at that one moment, in that one place, you have the power to go against any law that has ever passed, anywhere. You just void it right there. You can do that. And that's an incredible power. And yet what happens once the jury's done, what happens to that jury? Will that jury ever meet again?
No.
Never, ever, ever. So you have one time where 12 citizens come together, and they are citizens. They're you and me. As a libertarian, I hear libertarians complain all the time about, oh, mandatory jury duty. To me, that's the one thing you should be so honored to do, even though it's a pain in the butt. This is the freest institution, and juries are the clearest way to protect the free people. So this is exactly what Otis says. He walks into this room and says, who are you three judges? You've made up your own law. Your law came from some body in England that gave you power to come and rule on our trade. Who are you to do that? This isn't even a legitimate law court. These are not legitimate judges. And the reason you're doing this is because you know if you used our law, which by the way was your law, you just kind of forgot about it. If you did that, you know you'd lose. And therefore, the only reason you're making up courts is because you know if you actually abided by the real law, you'd fail. So you're making this stuff up, and that's what Otis says. And he goes beyond this, and for the first time that we have in a public document, Otis also says to the judges, it's not just the common law to defend, it's the natural right of every citizen everywhere to live as God created that person. That's what Otis says. So this is the first serious time, even though, again, it's a strange circumstance, but he's in that courtroom and he starts talking about life, liberty, and property, taking this, of course, from John Locke, but a much longer tradition. So is that everybody kind of clear on that? So think about what we get from common law. These are all common law rights. Every one of us, even if the police don't always enforce it, and governments go back and forth. So our Supreme Court sometimes is very, very pro-common law. Sometimes it's not. We're in a situation now where it's going to be really interesting to see where we're hanging on a knife's edge, really, at the moment, about what's going to happen. But here's the way a true search and seizure order should work. And don't, you guys, I hope you know, and I'm recording this, so you could always come back at me if you need. Don't actually do what I'm saying, because you'll get arrested. But I'm telling you what the tradition is. So, it should be right. What I'm telling you should be what common law is. It just doesn't work this way anymore. So, when a policeman, and we'll just use, again, a hypothetical. Let's have somebody break the law here. We'll have Hannah break the law. All right, so Hannah decides, and I don't even know how old you are, Anna, so I'm just going to say you're 19. So Hannah's 19, and she wants to get some alcohol, and it's illegal. And she knows that in Hillsdale, everybody knows her. So she thinks, well, I'll just cross down into Indiana. They may not sell it to me, but no matter what, they're not going to know me. So I'll drive down to Fremont. I'll go to the one liquor store. I think there's one liquor store. I'll drive in. I'll get some liquor, and I'll drive back. And okay. So the police get wind. Let's say that Josh, he's kind of a jerk, really. Josh calls the police and says, and he's mad because he wants you to go down and drink at Johnny D's, right? So he's not down there. So you know, he calls the police and he says, look, Hannah's driving down. Here's her car. And this is going on. And so the police pull over Hannah. They wait until she's bought the liquor, and these idiots down in Fremont sell it to her, right? And so she's coming back, and she crosses the border, and the police pull her over. Well, they only have probable cause for one thing, and that is they can search for alcohol she bought at a store in Fremont, Indiana, which means that if she happens to have on her back seat a sidearm, they actually have to ignore it. Because their only probable cause was she had alcohol. and anything else that's in there, that's not what they pulled her over for. And this is what is going on with the writs of general assistance. If I'm going to raid a warehouse and I'm the FBI, if I actually followed English common law, I would have to say, this is where we think it is. It's in this closet, in this room, in this part of the warehouse. I cannot just raid somebody's warehouse or home as a policeman and look everywhere. I have to have a, not general, but a very specific search warrant that says it's here, and if it's not there, you blew it. You totally blew it. Now, there may be a lot of us in this room who like law and order, and so we think, well, gosh, the cops should be able to search around. But that's not common law. And the reason common law develops is specifically because you don't want to grant the authorities that kind of power. You want to give them power. They've got to do their job. But they have to do it properly. It can't be sloppy. It can't be, oh, I pulled over Hannah for alcohol, and then I found a bag of pot in her trunk. We're going to arrest her. I can't do that. And Hannah, you know, I have no idea what Hannah does in her free time. But this is what, and it's very, very hard for that. Because, you know, we have judges who often just issue these huge things. Yeah, go take this person out or go. And, you know, we've seen what happens. It's bad. It's really bad. And yet, if I were a policeman, I'd probably want those powers, too, that were a little bit more expansive, not so narrow. But that's why, even when you go back and watch detective movies from the 40s and 50s, they were stricter then. There were certain things you had to do. And we're in a time period right now where it's kind of loose. So I'm not asking you necessarily to agree or disagree, but I want you to understand that, for example, in our Fourth Amendment, when it says, you know, we may not go into a person's property without search and seizure and probable cause, that's not just, oh, I think Josh is a bad guy, I'm going to go check out his home and his car. No, I have to know where he got the stuff, I have to know what he's planning to do with it, and I also have to assume he's going to use it for ill intent, and it has to be in a specific spot. So that's how it worked, and that was search and seizure in the British tradition. Now, there's a counter to that, and of course, what does this mean in common law? And I was very serious about the gun. What does this also mean in common law? As a citizen, what am I also, and in fact, not just a right to be, but a duty to be? What am I? I'm a soldier. Every citizen is a soldier. Every citizen is his own policeman. So I wasn't trying to shock you with the gun in the back seat. In fact, in common law, you would expect everybody to own a gun. It's one reason the police don't come raid your whole house. They're pretty nervous. And this was part of common law. So it's not enough to be a citizen and know the law. You also, as a citizen, must be a defender of the law. And that means of your rights as well. So when we talk about, and I hear good people saying things like this, well, and I'm not an NRA guy, so don't worry, I'm not trying to promote any kind of propaganda here, but it's just true in common law. When I hear people say, look, of course in that day and age, everybody had to have guns because they were farmers and they had to take care of predators and so forth. Well, yeah, that's true, but that's not at all what the Second Amendment was about. The Second Amendment goes all the way back to pre-Christian times in England. You have to be armed. If you're a human, you defend yourself. That's just as much a part of life as anything else. Just as there's no excuse for ignorance of the law, there's no excuse for not defending yourself. Now, in most places in America, that's not going to go over well. You know, imagine if in Boston there were a case where there was a home invasion and somebody shot the invader, and maybe they didn't have to, or maybe it's unclear. Well, a Boston jury would probably throw that guy, the home defender, in prison. In Texas, they'll cheer you on. It's like, oh yeah, I mean, you should have put the criminal down. In fact, in Texas, they will tell you, you have a moral duty. If someone violates your property, you actually have a moral duty to kill that person. Because otherwise, you're making the rest of the community suffer for your inability to make a manly decision. Because now they're going to threaten everybody else. Now, again, I'm just telling you how it is, right? You can take it any way you want. And I promise you, if you get pulled over and the cop says, oh, by the way, I'm going to look in your trunk, well, you can say, hey, my history professor said you can't do that, but that's probably going to get you in more trouble. So just know, I mean, you should know what the history is. You should also know what the reality is. That's not going to go over well.
But the fact that we're innocent until proven guilty, it's common law. The fact that the government cannot hold us without bail or access to a lawyer, it's common law. The fact that the government cannot hold our body for longer than a certain period of time, habeas corpus, they don't have the right to us, to our property. They don't have the right to that. So they can only hold us for a certain amount of time. That's all common law. And yet, if any one of you asks me, okay, Dr. Berzer, show me the exact origin in history where that started, if I could show you, it wouldn't be common law. And this is one of the weirdest things about common law. All of common law is based on precedent for cases, but the actual principles of common law are always, as people will say, beyond human memory. And if it's not beyond human memory, it's probably not common law. Now, think about that for our age, which loves facts and data and absolutes. People don't like hearing, oh yeah, well, we have that because it's beyond memory. That's, are you a nut? And that's a problem for us, because for those of us who believe in common law, it's always been defended because it's a good thing it arrived out of memory. And yet, that's very difficult if you want to prove why it exists. So it's very hard. Okay, so let me just break these down into what laws are. Hopefully you all have a sense of what common law is. So common law is specifically, it's in all of the Scandinavian countries, and it's in all the English-speaking countries. We're the only peoples who have it. It came out of the Germans. There's customary law in every culture, but a kind of formal common law that develops and evolves that's only in English-speaking and Germanic-speaking countries, and not in all of Germanic-speaking countries. But anybody know there are two states in America, now they have common law, but originally they didn't. Out of all 50, 48 have common law, two don't. Anybody want to take a guess what those two would be?
Hawaii.
Not Hawaii, that's a good guess. Hawaii, because it came so late, had common law. They didn't have it there. It wasn't native to Hawaii, but when there was settlement there, it developed. So that's a great guess. Anybody? Yeah.
California.
No, that's good. The only, yes, sir. Florida, good guesses. Strangely, you'd think the Spanish ones would be, right? That makes sense. It's actually the French colonies. The French colonies used, so Arkansas and Louisiana, they had what would be French law or Roman law. So they didn't have common law. It took a while for that to develop. But you do see a difference in the culture. So, you know, I think about this. Forget language for a moment. In fact, totally forget language. You know, our Constitution, U.S. Constitution, looks identical. Maybe there are a few changes, but almost identical to the Mexican Constitution. Canada has no Constitution. They're very proud of that. Canadians don't want a Constitution. And yet, Canadians have common law, Mexicans don't. And it's an interesting, so you've got to ask, well, which is the more influential on the people, the common law or the constitutional law? Right? So just think about that. I don't have an answer, but I find that an interesting thing, that on the surface, our laws look much more like Mexico, but in reality, they have more of a basis of what Canadians have as well. And the same with New Zealanders and Australians, anywhere the English settled and Scandinavians did as well. Okay, canon law, we're not going to go over much. Right now, canon law just means church law. Canon is church, so canon is an argument. And canon law, usually only Roman Catholics still use that term, especially on things like divorce. They'll talk about canon law, and there are canon lawyers still. Notre Dame has canon lawyers. But this would have been big, as you can imagine, in the Middle Ages. It's not so important now, but church law based on scripture and tradition. Roman law is something different. Roman law is what the English started practicing that Otis was against. Roman law is just a fancy word for saying centralized authority from the top down. So we use, it's not specifically from Rome, but it's how the empire worked. So we use that term. So if we have a law that the federal government forces on us because they think it's right and has nothing to do with common law, maybe even a violation of common law, it's still a form of Roman law. Natural law is exactly what it seems, and actually natural and universal law are the same, so I should put both. Just keep that out for a moment. Oh, you know what? They have a thing called an eraser. Use that. So natural law is truly the law of nature or God. And it means things such as physically, well, none of us are going to doubt that the sun will set tonight. And none of us are going to doubt that the sun will rise tomorrow. It may stop, but it does, obviously. The world has changed dramatically. We're in the apocalypse or something. So in normal times, we can see the laws of nature. These laws then can also be applied to human behavior. So we know that, for example, in every culture, everywhere, murder of in-group people is wrong. That has always been. There's a natural law that you don't diminish your community through murder. You may murder someone in another community, hopefully not, but you never do in your own community. So those are the kinds of things that natural law can apply to. And then for the top one, I have of nations. This is always ambiguous. This is basically agreement over time, kind of customs that develop in the way people treat each other country to country. So the law of nations could be a good thing. It could also be a very bad thing. Typically, law of nations says that we will respect one another's rights on the high sea, things like that, which are good. But then there are other things as well. For example, in war, it is usually regarded that with the law of nations, whoever conquers another place can do whatever it wants with that place. It can remake it if it wants. So it's an interesting thing. Okay, the other thing then that I want to talk about today, and just very quickly, because I think covering, I hope, the common law, you understood a lot of this, are rights. Rights are a funny thing. They're wonderful. You think of natural rights. But rights are a funny thing because, much like the common law, they can't be proven. They can only be asserted. So it is very difficult to prove a natural law. And as you've all seen by looking at what we have with our document here, the Declaration of Independence, our natural rights are, as Jefferson puts it, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Now, we could agree or disagree with some of those. We may not even say that those are actually our natural rights, and we may still believe in natural rights. So a natural right is that thing which allows us to be human. It is natural. It applies to everyone, male, female, black, white, yellow, bronze, I mean, it just doesn't matter. All humans must be a part of it, like the common law. So natural rights must be for everyone. In fact, if one person does not have a natural right, then nobody can. So one exception and it's over. So everybody must have it. And what a natural right is also called sometimes in political theory a negative right. And it simply means, as we talked about very briefly on Monday, it means that the only thing that I need to do to allow you to do well is to step back and allow you to do it. In other words, my negative response is merely a restraint. So for Josh to thrive, all I have to do is step back and allow him to thrive. Now that's a pretty bleak society, I would say. I think it's a great society in the sense that we can be ourselves. But it doesn't say I can't be charitable and help Josh along the way. But the implication can be that, look, we all are just a society of serious individuals, and we all allow our individuality to develop. I don't think it's that cold, but it could be seen that way. But a natural right is a negative right. So this is why Jefferson comes up with life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. I don't have to do a single thing to help any of you attain that. I merely don't hurt you, and you can do this. That's a natural right. But there are others. Locke says property. And we can talk about what the distinction is between the pursuit of happiness and property. But these things are deeply rooted in society. A positive right, then, would be much more related to Roman law. So natural right and natural law almost always go together, as do common law and natural right. But positive law says, okay, you have a right to housing and free medical care. Now, those may be very, very good things, or a right to a free school lunch. Those may be very good things, but they are called positive rights because the only way they can happen is if I take from one person to give to another. In other words, the positive means action. I must act. I must put forth positive energy in order, or I must put forth energy in order to have this happen. So it's not the neutrality. It is an active redistribution of one person's resources to another to make it happen. So most laws in society are positive rights. Most things are positive rights. And some positive rights are totally necessary, even in a completely free society. Simply because if you're going to protect society, we still need resources to hire police. We need resources to have a military. So you're always going to have some positive rights and some positive action. Unless you're an anarchist, then you wouldn't necessarily. Then it would just be private. But in any governmental structure, you're going to have some positive rights. The question is, how far do you take that? So I'll never forget the first year I was teaching this. It's sort of been 21 years ago now. In my first semester in grad school, but teaching American history, I remember listening to a radio show because I was commuting between Bloomington, Indiana, and Fort Wayne. And as I was driving, I was listening to a radio talk show where a person called up and said, "Look, the people, the county lawnmowers are out right now. At the moment that allergies are very high, I have a right not to have my allergies exacerbated." Well, okay. I mean, that's where we start getting into how far do rights go? At what point do you really have a right to do this or that? At what point do you not have that? And we're in a situation now where we seem to think lots of things are rights. And at least as a country, we seem to think that. So, rights of conquest, related to the laws of nations. This is the idea that when you take over a people, you have the right to remake them. Americans have generally not bought into that. Not always, at least in our history traditionally, we have not. But rights of conquest basically say the victor, to the victor goes the spoils. Inherited rights are much more complicated, and I'm not going to get into them too much. For right now, I just want you to know that they go with common law rights. So, as a native English speaker, I can claim, legitimately, that I have inherited the rights of Englishmen. And those may be natural rights, but they may be something like a right to a trial by jury, which you would never call a natural right, even though it fits beautifully with natural rights. But you couldn't find that in nature, a right to a trial by jury. But I can by custom and inheritance. So, I want you to think about this for a moment. Let's be really non-politically correct, and yet I think still really critical. Of all the peoples we've talked about so far that settled America, remember the four free migrations and the one unfree? Who's going to have the hardest time claiming natural right and claiming inherited rights? It should be fairly obvious. It'd be Africans, right? Well, one reason it's so difficult for Africans to claim rights, skin color is going to matter. But it's also, imagine in the system of slavery what happens. We grab one person from this tribe, and another person from a tribe 100 miles away, and then another person from a tribe 300 miles away, and they're all put in the same ship, they're all sold in the same market. They don't speak each other's language, they don't have the same gods, they don't have the same dress, they don't have the same heroism or ancestors. And one of the things that the English have above everybody else is that they can assert, hey, we've got these rights that we've inherited. Whether blacks have them or not, and of course they would have to have natural rights by the definition of natural rights, it's very difficult to enforce it because they can't make the claim of inherited rights because their inheritance is disruption, warfare, and slavery. It's very difficult. And I want you to know this because Abraham Lincoln's solution to this, which is ingenious, is to create all black regiments in the Civil War so that they can prove and create a tradition of that very thing. And that it's essential. It's happened to any people. It doesn't matter if you're black, white, or what. It's just essential to any people to have a past. It's very difficult to be free if you have no past. Very difficult. And we'll keep talking about that, but it's very hard. Okay, so any questions about any of this? I hope it wasn't too dry, but I just want you to know, to break these things down and understand where these rights are. So the Americans, with James Otis,
really begin a tradition of believing in common law and natural rights. And that's why, and I know my other section, we didn't get time to do this, but it's one reason that I had you read out loud the first part of the Declaration. Because the first part of the Declaration is all about natural law and natural rights. But the entire remainder, which is 80%, is all common law violations committed by the king. So the part we don't memorize, but if we look down, if you guys would turn to page 128 for a moment. And there are a couple of things here that may seem odd to us, but we need to think about exactly what they are. So what do we have? Well, right there, line 29 on page 128, he has refused consent to laws the most wholesome and necessary for the public good. Well, those laws can only come from our village. They can't come from anyone, because we're here. So he's trying to impose things that go against our common good, the republic. He's violating that. He has forbidden his governors to pass laws of immediate and pressing importance unless suspended in their operation until his assent should be obtained. And when so suspended, he has utterly neglected to attend them. Jump down a little bit on the next page, 129. Look at line 10. He has endeavored to prevent the population of these states. For that purpose, obstructing the laws for naturalization of foreigners, refusing to pass others to encourage their migrations hither, and raising the conditions of new appropriation of land. He has obstructed the administration of justice by refusing his assent to laws for establishing judiciary powers, and so forth. All right, jump down another one. He has erected a multitude of new offices and sent hither swarms of officers to harass our people and eat out their sustenance. And he has kept among us in times of peace standing armies. There's no greater danger to a free people than a standing army. Because why would that thing stand unless to oppress us? Because remember, in common law, we defend ourselves. It's not true with the Navy. It's fine to have a standing Navy. But for those of you who've read the Constitution, how long can any bill Congress passes affect the U.S. Army, the Air Force, though the Air Force obviously is not mentioned, or the Marines? Anybody know? If Congress passes a piece of legislation, whether for a pay raise to soldiers or the development of a new tank, how long can that bill last? 2 years. We can never have a bill in Congress dealing with the military, not the Navy. The Navy's totally accepted in this. You can make a 100 or 1,000-year plan for the Navy if you want. You cannot for the Army. Because they never... Say that again?
Would the Marines be accepting this?
Yeah, that's a tough question, right? Where do they fit? They are land forces, but they're transported by the Navy. So the chances are good they would be exempted from this. Simply because if there were standing Marines, they'd be standing on the deck of the ship, right? So they probably would be exempted. But the goal is never to have a standing army on your own soil. That's the goal. And it's because you don't know what they're going to do with it. Now, let me point out, thank you for that. So let me point out one last thing. And that is one thing that I think we all get confused about. And this is the law or the point where Jefferson says in the Declaration, and you have forced slavery upon us. And we all think, what? That's hypocritical. Well, in the common law, there can never be slavery. Slavery's been illegal from day one, as far as we know in the common law. Because imagine, if we had a society of people in which there could not be the negation of a conflict, you can't have common law. Common law must apply to every single person in your community. And common law was never accepted. And so I'm not excusing Jefferson. There's definitely a bit of hypocrisy in here. But there's also, logically, his argument makes total sense. We could never have had slaves here without you fooling around with new laws and establishing new systems of law. If you just stuck to the common law, we'd never have slaves, ever. That's why there's no slavery on English soil in England. But you can allow it here because you've used colonial law, which is not real, it's fake, according to this. So there is actually a logic to it. It's hypocritical, but there is a logic to it. Okay, and that, look at that. We're 5 seconds over. Have a good day, everybody. No new readings for Friday, but I would like you to have read the play for Monday. Okay, so read Cato a Tragedy for Monday. We're going to talk about the Northwest Ordinance and keep talking about the Declaration on Friday. So God bless. Have a good Wednesday and Thursday. Hey, Katie.
Well, first of all, I apologize if I'm a bit off in the
Oh, no problem. No problem at all. No worries. Glad you're here.
But also, is there any
Yeah, no, that's a good question.